The November midterm elections are just weeks away, and ensuring voters have enough information about each candidate is crucial to the democratic process. At Wisconsin Public Radio, we have a strong commitment to ensuring voters head to the polls with as much information as possible, ensuring an informed electorate. Today, we feature conversations with candidates for Wisconsin's 28th, 29th, and 34th Assembly districts. The 28th Assembly District is in western Wisconsin. It encompasses most of Polk County. Today, we'll be speaking with Patty Schachner, the Democrat who is running for the seat. Her opponent, Republican incumbent Gabe Magnifici, did not respond to our invitation to participate. Also today, we'll speak with Democrat Danielle Johnson, who is running in the 29th Assembly District. The 29th represents residents in most of Dunn County and portions of St. Croix and Polk counties, and is currently represented by Republican Clint Moses, who did not respond to an invitation to discuss his campaign with us. But first, we'll turn to Wisconsin's 34th Assembly District, which covers all of Vilas and most of Oneida counties in northern Wisconsin. Later, we'll speak with Democrat Eileen Daniel, but first we'll hear from the incumbent in the race, Republican Representative Rob Swearingen. This year's midterm elections will be held November 8th in Wisconsin.
Just finishing up my fifth term in the Wisconsin State Assembly, I have been proud to represent the people here in the 34th Assembly District. I'm a business owner, lived in Rhinelander all my life. My wife and I, both of us, lived in Rhinelander all of our lives. I raised two kids here, went to the public school system here, as well as my kids, and my wife and I just started our 30th year at the local restaurant, local supper club here in Rhinelander.
Well, let's talk about the economy. And as a business owner, I'm sure that you can relate to this. Businesses are really having a hard time getting workers, more jobs open than workers available. What do you think lawmakers could do to help mitigate this situation?
Yeah, this is a problem that affects me personally. I have that issue at the restaurant where we're, you know, burning out the people we have because we're been so busy. People have been coming up to the Northwoods. It's been great. But to answer your question, I think we can do a better job with the Department of Workforce Development. And in this last cycle, we did have a package of bills that addressed the stuff that was going to hopefully help some of these businesses out with people. But and there was a package of bills, I think there was about nine of them in there. I mean, it addressed things like the ghost interview, where the applicant would come in and schedule an interview and then just simply not show up. Mm-hmm. And that adds to the frustration of the business person. You know, things like food share, work requirements, creating a reemployment assistance program, refusing to work to remain on assistance. I mean, those types of things. But unfortunately, it fell deaf on the governor's ear, and he did not sign those package of bills. So that just adds, once again, more to the frustration. And this is not a problem that's just strictly affecting the Northwoods of Wisconsin. It's all over this state and quite frankly, all over the nation. So I'm hoping that, if we have a different governor, that we can reintroduce these bills and move forward and maybe provide some help or some relief to get some people back to work.
Inflation continues to be a very big issue for many working families. What legislative steps would you take to address rising inflation and fears of recession?
Yeah, you know, and inflation, I mean, not casting the blame on the federal level, but certainly with what's been going on federally in the last two to four years, the amount of money that's been spread across the United States after COVID, somebody sooner or later has to pay for that. And so, in Wisconsin, just most recently, the governor come out with what I consider a campaign ploy in the fact that he wanted to take $600 million and disperse it back to people, a couple months here before the election. I think that's his way of adding to inflation in the state of Wisconsin. But largely, it has to stop on the federal level.
I'd like to ask you about the abortion issue. This is looming large in this election. And, of course, Wisconsin's abortion ban was reinstated after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Do you think that Wisconsin's existing abortion law should be updated in any way?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, I'm pro-life. And so that's pretty much how I use to guide my decisions as a lawmaker. But I believe that once this next session gets underway, just after the first of the year, I expect that there will be many bills that will come out to address abortion. Certainly, I would entertain exceptions for rape and incest, along with the life of the mother, which is currently in place. But I'm guessing that we're not going to be interested in any of the extreme ideas that have come out of the left. I mean, abortion because a baby is the wrong gender or race or has Down syndrome. These types of things just are unacceptable. And so stuff like that I certainly would oppose.
Let's talk a little bit about education. This has become a very hot topic in this election as well. What is your top priority when it comes to education for Wisconsin?
Well, yeah, I think we have to back up for a second before my top priority. I think what's really wonderful here is that we've seen parents now getting much more involved in the students' education. I've seen it here in Rhinelander. We're seeing it up in Eagle River at Northland Pines. I think that's just great that the parents are looking at the curriculum. They're looking at the district, and they're asking questions. And I think that's important. Beyond that, I think that it's great that they have options to send their children to different schools. So through open enrollment up in this area, if the parent isn't comfortable with what's going on in the district, they can always open enroll to the next district closer or wherever they want to go. So those are great things I think they're starting. Above that, of course, education is one of the biggest things that's in the state budget. So it'll be interesting seeing, first of all, what the governor proposes as far as education in his budget probably somewhere around February, and then ultimately in July when the Joint Finance Committee and the legislature gets done to see where we land. Coming off of this last session, there were some record amounts of money that were put into school districts through federal dollars, and that was one-time money. And so now we're faced, difficult decisions. Even though we've had increases in the budget for education each cycle, that one-time money will eventually be gone, and now we'll have to face the impact of that as well.
We talked a little bit a couple minutes ago about the fact that students in the Northwoods have some choices. Their parents have choices when it comes to where to send them to school. So they have that, but what role do you think schools should play in teaching children about social issues? There's some debate over this, like race and sexuality. Should that be taught in the schools?
Yeah, and here again, there's a big story coming out of Eau Claire that the Eau Claire School District is being sued because children are having the discussion about assigning their own agenda and not even including the parents in the conversation. So this is where the parents are starting to get involved. The critical race theory issues. I think that the schools need to be much, much more transparent about what exactly is going on with their curriculum. And again, the parents need to be much more engaged in the direction their child is learning. So it's a genuine issue, and it just crept up in the Northland Pines School District a couple weeks ago, where it got pretty vocal.
Let's turn our attention to public safety. Obviously, there have been many deadly shootings this year and a lot of discussion about this. How do you propose to keep schools and communities safe in the wake of these deadly shootings? And how can that be accomplished while balancing Second Amendment rights?
Yeah, and Second Amendment is dear to everybody up here in the Northwoods, that's for sure. I think we're headed in the right direction when it comes to the school safety officers. And then, back in 2017, we created the Office of School Safety, which I think has been beneficial to these districts as well. So do we need to get retired police officers into these schools? Resource officers that are currently there now doing a great job. There also was a bill passed in 2021, I believe it was, where we created the critical incident mapping grants for schools. So the law enforcement works with the school district to map out the critical parts of the school, and that's a good thing. But clearly, when these insidious incidents happen, it gets shed much more limelight, and it could happen anywhere, and we've seen that. But things like red flag laws, I don't think is gonna help us out. There were no red flags back in the Uvalde shooting as well. So I think we're doing a good job. We're in the right direction when we have actually police officers in the schools. Whether or not the teachers should be armed with a gun could be a whole new discussion in the future. I don't know if that's realistic or not, but something that should be talked about and put on the table.
How do you think that the state should address contamination by PFAS and other chemicals? So many communities are struggling with this, trying to find ways to keep their water supply safe, for example. How should the state address this situation?
Yeah, well, and this hits home because Rhinelander, where I'm from, my hometown, has got two wells shut down because of PFAS contamination. They've been working with the University of Wisconsin to get some studies done. They got some help out of Senator Baldwin's office through some federal money that they haven't realized yet, but hopefully it's on its way. The DNR and the Department of Natural Resources Board have worked together, and finally I think they have come up with some sort of a final number where we can actually start saying this is where the water is contaminated. And it's been a very frustrating issue for us. I mean, I sponsored a bill a couple of years back with, at that time, Representative John Nygren, who had the same problem in Marinette, to give these communities some money to clean up the water. So this is an ongoing issue that certainly needs to be continued to put on the front burner.
Rob, we have about 30 seconds left, and I just want to give you that time to share things that separate you from other candidates and what you want voters to know.
Yeah, you bet. Well, I think that, you know, my background certainly is hospitality, and so tourism and hospitality is kind of like always been my focus. But I've learned a lot over the last 10 years in the State House. I mean, education, PFAS is another thing that has come up and continues. The school funding formula continues to frustrate people. So I'm looking forward, to getting back down there, getting back to work on those issues, as well as broadband. I'm happy to say that the 34th Assembly District with the 12th Senate District has been the recipient of the most broadband grants in the state of Wisconsin. We just got another one up in Eagle River here a week ago. So those are the big issues for me, and I'm looking forward to representing once again. I'm applying to the voters of the 34th Assembly District once again to be their representative for the next 2 years.
You're hearing special election coverage on WPR, where we just heard from Republican Rob Swearingen, candidate for Wisconsin's 34th Assembly District. Ahead, we'll hear from his challenger, Democrat Eileen Daniel. That conversation is next on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to special election coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. Earlier, we heard from Republican Rob Swearingen, the incumbent who is seeking another term to represent the state's 34th Assembly District. Now, Rick Ryer speaks with his challenger, Democrat Eileen Daniel.
I am City Council President of Rhinelander, and I've raised my three kids here. I've lived in Rhinelander and Oneida County for 18 years. And when the seat came open, I was excited to run. I think it's time for a change in leadership at the state level. There's way too many issues coming down to decision-making at the state level. And I want to make sure there's folks in there who have everyone's best interest at heart.
Let's start off with the economy. Businesses today face significant workforce challenges with more jobs open than workers are available. What can lawmakers do to help mitigate this situation?
If there's one thing we learned from the pandemic, it's that workers can find a way to make a way on their own. And so incentivizing businesses to offer better benefits, incentivizing them to increase their wages, I think will go a long way towards increasing folks willing to go back into the workforce rather than, you know, finding their way on their own.
Inflation really is a top of mind issue for many working families throughout Wisconsin. What steps can be taken at the state level to address rising inflation and fears of recession, and what legislative steps would you consider taking?
So as you know, Governor Evers has put in place the means to get more money into the hands of taxpayers. We're taking the surplus that we have and giving that right back. The other thing is wages have to increase. We've seen inflation rising and rising and rising. Minimum wage hasn't moved in over two decades. And so making families able to survive on one or two jobs is crucial. I know we've got some programs here in Rhinelander. The Rhinelander School District is helping families by providing all school supplies this year. That's a great step. I would love to see that happen statewide.
Should Wisconsin's existing abortion law be updated in any way?
Absolutely. 1849. Come on, what else was in place in 1849? We still had slavery. Women were considered property. The entire population of Wisconsin at that time was 304,000. That was the entire population of the state in 1849. Obviously, we've come a long way in the medical field. And a lot of people don't know that the reason that ban was put in place in the first place was not for pro-life purposes, or for, you know, protecting the fetus. The reason that abortion ban was put in place is that women were dying. Women were dying from abortions. The other thing that hadn't happened in 1849, germ theory. So women were getting infected. Women were dying young because of these procedures, and that's why it was put in place. Over the years, it was updated, it was changed. But once Roe v. Wade was overturned, we went right back to that 1849 law because nothing had been updated once Roe v. Wade went into place.
On the issues of education and education policy, what would your top priority be?
Oh, boy. I have so many friends and acquaintances who are teachers. We really, really need to make sure that our schools are funded and they are funded equally. As a lot of people know, up here in the Northwoods, we are considered property rich and tax poor. A lot of the property up here is owned by, not all of it, but a lot of it is owned by folks who don't consider this their permanent residence. They don't have voting rights. And so even though we have all of this property, which, should relate to referendums and such, it just doesn't because those folks aren't here. And so what we end up with is having to go back to referendum anytime we can. And it would be great if there was an equal and fair funding system, funding formula that would make sure that all schools are funded and that we can pay our teachers well, that we can pay our staff well, so that we're giving our children the very best opportunity they could possibly have in their educational experience.
What role, Eileen, should schools play in teaching children about social issues such as race or sexuality?
Oh, I was wondering if we were going to talk about critical race theory. I noticed you didn't use that term. I think history should be taught truthfully, honestly. And sometimes that's going to make folks uncomfortable. But when does anybody ever grow as a person unless they have at some point felt uncomfortable? We have an uncomfortable history. And so, you've heard the term, you can't, if those who don't learn from the past are destined to repeat it. I really do think that holds in this case. We've seen so much slide backwards in the 4 years that we had an unfortunate president who was not shy in his manner of speaking about certain people that he didn't like, who really opened the door for certain white supremacist groups to really become more vocal. People who were hiding in the shadows have now come out. And so our children are seeing this. Our children are way more savvy about this than we ever were. I'm in my 50s. And so when I was growing up, we didn't have the world in our face 24/7. These kids have phones. They have the internet. They know what's going on. They see what's going on. And so when they're in school and they're being told something different than what they know to be true, they're going to question everything else. Not that questioning's bad, but then they're going to question motives. And we really do need to take a step back and say, what are we teaching these kids? How do we do it in a way that they understand it? And I get so frustrated when folks talk about critical race theory and how it's being taught to grade school age children, which just isn't the truth because it's a postgraduate level theory that is quite complicated and quite complex. And there's no way that grade school age children are ever going to understand it. What folks are most afraid of is feeling uncomfortable.
How do we keep our schools and communities safe in the wake of recent deadly shootings?
I'll tell you a little story. I have three children. My oldest is 20. And she never knew a year of school without an active shooter drill. And I believe when she was about 12, I remember her coming home and telling us that this year the shooter drills had changed because they realized that the kids who were, or the people who were coming back and doing the shooting, or the high schoolers that were going in and doing the shooting, had gone through all the shooter drills. And so they knew where everybody was going to be. So they had to change everything up. How sad is that? We have a gun culture up here. I completely understand that. My family owns guns. My husband hunts. We have hunting rifles. My husband was in the military. We have a handgun for personal protection. It is kept in the house. It is kept locked up. And all of our children have gone through training to understand gun safety. I see absolutely no reason why military-grade assault rifles should be in civilian homes, in civilian hands. These are guns that were made to kill the most people in the shortest amount of time. That's why they're the weapon of choice. You go in, you're not leaving witnesses. There are ways to have safe schools, safe communities, and it starts with banning assault rifles. I'll come right out and say it. For any item that needs a background check, it should not be available in one-to-one sales or at gun shows, those sorts of things. So at the very minimum, I would want to see universal background checks, not just statewide, universal background checks, a three-day waiting period, and no sale, no private sales of those items.
How can this be accomplished while balancing Second Amendment rights?
Wow. You know, the Second Amendment is very vague. It's one sentence, basically. And while I do agree we should be able to protect ourselves, we should be able to hunt, nowhere in the Second Amendment does it say we should be able to kill large numbers of people in a short period of time. Many, many smarter folks than I am have said in the past, the folks who wrote the Constitution could not possibly have foreseen weapons that we have now.
Turning now a little bit to the environment, Eileen, how should the state address contamination by PFAS and other chemicals in local water supplies in the state?
As you mentioned, I'm City Council President and Rhinelander. And Rhinelander was actually one of the first communities in Wisconsin to find PFAS in their city water supply. And how we responded was we immediately shut down two of our eight wells, and we continued to test our water. Luckily, the other six wells are a lot. We haven't found PFAS in them yet at all. And so that's how we handled it. However, if we ever had a situation where we needed those wells, we have to find a way to get that out of our system. There was legislation put in place through the state legislature regarding PFAS. And what they did was allocate money to communities to help them remediate their water systems. However, that legislation also said that if the community took the money, they could not go after the corporations or the responsible parties for contaminating the water system. Now, originally the legislation did not have that caveat in it. That was put in there by the Republicans. And so when Evers and Josh Call realized that this was the only way we were going to get any money into communities, they said, great, fine, we'll put this through. Then they turned around and they filed a lawsuit against companies shown to manufacture these chemicals by the state. This was a nice bump for us and for other communities, because we could still get the money to remediate the water systems, and we didn't have to worry about alienating any possible corporations from coming into our communities, as long as they're willing to put systems in place to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Eileen Daniel, in the last minute, would you please share a couple of things that separate you from your opponent and anything else you'd like voters to know about you that we haven't discussed?
Well, I am tenacious. And anything that I feel like I don't have a strong knowledge of, I will seek it out. I will research the heck out of it, so that when I am making decisions at a state level, if I am making decisions on putting forth legislation or voting on legislation, I'm going to understand it. I'm going to know what I'm voting on. And I do know that my opponent has been in office for 10 years and has basically been a Republican placeholder that votes party lines and hasn't really put forth any original legislation that has helped Wisconsinites or specifically any of us up here in the Northwoods at all.
That was Rick Ryer speaking with Eileen Daniel, the Democratic candidate running for Wisconsin's 34th Assembly seat. Now, Ezra Wall speaks with Patty Schachner, the Democratic candidate for the state's 28th Assembly District. The Republican incumbent who holds the seat, Gay Magnifici, did not respond to our invitation to appear on this program.
My name is Patty Schachner. I was born and raised in Somerset, Wisconsin, on a farm near Bass Lake. We were a dairy farm, and married when I was 18, been married to my husband, Joel, for 42, going on 43 years. We have six kids and expecting our 13th grandchild. We're very excited. I spent most of my career working in emergency services, so ambulance, EMT, EMTI, teaching EMS classes, first aid, and CPR and EMT basic and EMT first responder classes. And then in about 2003, I transitioned. There was an opening as a death investigator. I was hired as a death investigator in St. Croix County. I've been doing death investigation now since 2003. In 2011, I was appointed to the chief medical examiner position. And I have been working in the chief medical examiner position ever since. And then basically in 2018, it's through my work, I believe, that I was asked to run for Senate, and I did, and won that special election. I lost in 2020, but that also was during COVID. So it was a really interesting time to be a legislator, yet still working as an essential worker in death investigation in the medical examiner's office. And then now, fast forward to now, had no intention of running for office. My life is really good the way it is, but the Dobbs decision came out. I have a 16-year-old granddaughter, and she was literally crying about the fact that her rights were being taken away. And that is literally what made me decide to run, is the fact that things that I took for granted and freedoms that I took for granted as a young girl and then as a mother were no longer available to my daughters and granddaughters. And I felt that I had to step up because no one else was. And if we're going to fight for our freedoms and democracy, you have to step up when no one else will.
On the issue of the economy, I'm wondering, with businesses today facing significant workforce challenges, more and more jobs open than workers available to fill them, what can the state legislature do to help put workers into jobs in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, we have such a low unemployment. There's, you know, lots of things that have to do with why we have this worker shortage. But the biggest thing is, in my opinion, is poor planning of the legislature in years past. You know, the fact that baby boomers were retiring is nothing new. We knew this was going to happen, and we haven't done really anything to shore up our workforce. And because of a lot of the bad policies that have been written, young people no longer want to stay in this area. You have to be able to educate a workforce and get them up to par to what's needed. Manufacturing, nursing, healthcare. So the fact that we didn't, the Republicans didn't write policy that addressed these issues. They've been in control since 2010, and it's 2022. There's been quite a while. This isn't a surprise. And now we're where we are now. And we have to figure out how to attract people to come here to address our workforce issues.
On the issue of education, that's something that legislators have a lot to do with in terms of funding, in terms of policy. What issues would be your top priorities if you're elected to this office in terms of education?
Well, there's a lot of things that we can do. I mean, our education, even though our funding is up, has been underfunding for so long, and there has been a actual aim to tear apart our education system. But I think one of the things that we could do to actually start restoring integrity in our education system is really doing something that we used to do all the time, and that is restoring driver's ed for our students. Most school, right now, it's mostly a private business. So all students, especially poor students in rural Wisconsin and poor students in urban areas, if they don't have the means to go to driver's ed as a graduating high school student, not only do you not have a valid ID, you don't have something to that little piece of paper that says you have a driver's license to get you from point A to point B. And from point A to point B can be the difference between living in poverty and starting graduating and going into access to a technical school. There's a lot of things that a driver's license can do, and it was intentional by policymakers to take driver's ed out of school, out of the education system, and that there has actually only hurt the poorest of the poor and the poor folks that live in urban areas. So for us, we don't have a lot of urban areas, but we have a lot of poverty in rural Wisconsin.
What should the role of parents be in issues of school curriculum being taught to their children? And what role should schools play in teaching social issues like race or sexuality? We've seen a lot of discussion about those issues, parents going to school board meetings and others. Talk about that.
So when you talk about history and where we were and where we've come and where we're going, I think factual history is important. I think the fact that there are parents that would like history to be whitewashed are not doing their children any favors, especially if you come from a rural area and then you do decide to go to a urban college, and it will hinder your experience because you won't go there having all these different ideas and educated on the different social things that are going on in the world. There is no community around that doesn't have gay parents. So the fact that we don't want to talk about, parenting and the LGBTQ topic is it doesn't matter to the students. It's the parents that are uncomfortable. And by really cherry picking what you want your child to learn, these are all things that should be coffee table and kitchen table topics at home with your children. Everybody watches the news. If you're watching the news and you're teaching and talking to your kids at home, what they learn at school should be, just another piece to it. So if you're not talking to your children at home about, comprehensive sex education, and you expect the school district to teach them some sort of sex education, it's not going to happen. And as someone who worked in a public school in the health office, seeing the ramifications of students not knowing about comprehensive sex education does not help them. And, it's really important. And now more than ever, we need to really talk to our kids and our grandkids and students about these topics so that when they get to school, they have the right information. But keeping that information away from them does not help them.
We're talking with Patty Schachner. She's the Democratic candidate for the 28th Assembly District. She faces the incumbent Republican Gay Magnifici in the election that is coming up on November the 8th. Patty, I want to ask you about the environment. How should state legislators address contamination by PFAS and other chemicals in local water supplies around the state?
Well, unfortunately, we have softened a lot of the teeth in legislation that is out there. That is why we are where we are. PFAS are pretty much in everywhere now. And I come from a community that we dealt with contaminated water in Star Prairie Township. And, once your water's bad, you're kind of screwed pretty much in that. And it takes decades and decades to remediate that there. So holding people responsible through good policy only makes sense. And of course, folks that, if you're super PACs are the ones that are writing your legislation on this stuff, and they're the ones that are paying to make sure that what they want, the least amount of environmental controls as possible, you know, that doesn't help everyday rural folks at all. And that is kind of the problem. When you write legislation and the intention is to keep the gray area gray, then the people who suffer the most are those that are most vulnerable. So as, you know, we look at everything that has been going on with water contamination and water in general, you look at what's going on in Mississippi, you look at what's going on with water with CAFOs, you look at, you know, all these different things. You know, independently, each thing looks like, well, it's not me, it's not me, it's not me. But you start putting these different topics together, and all of us can be touched and will be touched by water and water quality. So having legislation that makes sense, that protects everybody and protects our children and grandchildren so that they have clean water, should be everyone's goal.
We have about a minute or so remaining, and I want to give you that time to highlight what you think separates you from your opponent in this race.
For me, I think what separates myself and Representative Magnifici is the fact that I'm a proven problem solver and a proven worker. I went through and looked at Representative Magnifici's legislative page and calendar, and in the 21-22 session, she only showed up for work 109 days to do legislative work. She's paid to be a legislator. When you look at that and break it down and do the numbers, that's $1,100 a day plus mileage that she was paid, and she only has a 5% success rate in writing policy. So if you want a policy worker that is going to go to work for you and is actually going to try to write policy and get policy written that is going to make your life better, I'm your person. But if you're looking for a policymaker that is going to march and parade and sing songs, then Gay Magnifici is your person, because she's really good at that. Policy, not so much.
That was Ezra Wall speaking with Patty Schachner, the Democrat seeking Wisconsin's 28th Assembly seat. Her opponent, Republican Gay Magnifici, did not respond to our invitation to participate. When we return, we'll turn our attention to the race for Wisconsin's 29th Assembly seat. That conversation is next on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to special election coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio, part of our series of conversations with candidates for state and congressional offices throughout the state. Now, Rick Ryer talks with Democrat Danielle Johnson, candidate in Wisconsin's 29th Assembly District. Her opponent, Republican Clint Moses, did not respond to our invitation to participate.
I am a veterinarian, and I'm a business owner in Baldwin, and I am running because I am worried about the state of our democracy. We here in Wisconsin, we have gerrymandering, and we have many things that are in the way for a good and thriving democracy, and I want to be a part of the solution to keep this great system that we have going.
We're going to start off with the economy. Some questions there. Businesses today face significant workforce challenges, with more jobs open than there are workers available to fill them. What, from your perspective, can lawmakers do to help mitigate the situation?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, one thing, I think there's definitely some obstacles for people being able to pursue full-time work. In my situation, we do end up in the veterinary medicine. A lot of women are, mainly women, is our workforce. And I'm finding with employees that it's difficult. Childcare is a big obstacle, the amount of money that it costs, and its availability is huge. I think an expansion of early schooling, like with 4K, would be really helpful. So, you know, expanding our public education options to include younger children would be one way to get more people into the workforce and for them to be able to stay there too.
Inflation continues to be a top of mind issue for many working families related to childcare and other things in the state. What steps can be taken at the state level to address rising inflation and fears of a recession? And what legislative steps would you consider taking?
Yeah, when it comes to inflation and, you know, the broader economics mainly happen at the national and even the global scale. So at the state level, it is a little bit challenging, but it is also important because it is something that affects everyone here in the state of Wisconsin. One thing that I would be working on would be to support local farmers and more of a farm-to-fork situation to grow local food sources to increase the availability and hopefully decrease the cost of getting food to our table. And that also is important to be being able to vote to grow a diversity of food locally helps in much broader areas too when we find that there is supply chain problems. And also it's good for the environment as well to grow a variety of locally grown food.
Wisconsin's 172-year-old abortion ban was reinstated after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Should Wisconsin's existing abortion law be updated in any way?
Absolutely. The 1848 law is not adequate to provide for the needs of 2022. It needs to be updated. I found it was very appalling that the governor called lawmakers in to discuss this situation, and they gaveled in and gaveled out. It's incredibly insulting that that's how they think about women and people that can give birth, that a law that was created before women even had the vote would be adequate to address the complexity of women's needs surrounding pregnancy and childbirth.
Despite multiple government audits that show no evidence of fraud in the 2020 election, some Wisconsin voters still have concerns about election integrity. How would you address those concerns and restore faith in the voting process for these voters?
Restoring faith in the voting process is 100% up to the leaders, and leaders like our current state senator and our current representative. They have the opportunity to speak the truth, and they are making a conscious choice not to speak the truth about the 2020 election. The truth is that there was no evidence of fraud on any substantial level. Everything was upheld with every lawsuit that came before the state of Wisconsin. And when it comes to restoring confidence, all that needs to be done is for our leaders in Madison to speak the truth.
Turning now to education in education policy, what would your top priority be in this area?
My top priority would be to get closer to fully funding our schools. Right now, it's so much is left up to local governments and their ability to raise funds through tax levies. I am not for the privatization of our public schools. I think I would like to see teaching become more of a respected profession as it should be.
And what can we do to attract and maintain qualified teachers in the state?
Pay them a good wage, give them the autonomy to perform their job in the way that they were educated to do. People get into teaching because they love doing what they do. And as someone who, as a passionate member of a profession, I understand that. And when people are given the freedom and autonomy to, to practice their profession in the way that they were taught, then great things happen.
What role should schools play in teaching children about social issues such as race or sexuality?
We definitely need to learn our history where race is concerned, and I think that's what teachers have always done, and I think that that's what teachers should continue to do. And I think teachers have always created a space for their students to be themselves, and when that's related to whether a student is coming out as being trans or a student is coming out as being queer. Teachers have always created safe spaces for students to be themselves, and I would like to see them to be able to continue to do that.
And at the same time, how much authority or input should parents have over what curriculum is being taught to their children at school?
Well, curriculum happens at the school board level, and parents have always had input with school boards, been able to participate in those discussions. I think what's happening now is based on fears of that are mostly unfounded. There's nothing really new that has happened related to that. And I think instead of going backwards and recreating restrictions on teachers and school boards, the systems are in place for parents to already have input, and that should continue. But when it comes to removing freedoms, like the freedom of a teacher to have a rainbow flag in their room, when it comes to restricting freedoms of students to change their pronouns and sign their name with the pronoun of their choice, then I think that is a step backwards, and it's a fear-based tactic that should not be the trend for the future.
We're talking with Danielle Johnson, who is a Democrat running for the 29th State Assembly District. Danielle, how do we keep our schools and communities safe in the wake of recent deadly shootings?
Gun violence is a really complicated issue, and like many complicated issues, people want to have a simple answer rather than delve deep into the complexity of the issue and find the ways that we can solve these problems. So with gun violence prevention, the situation is very complicated, and we need to have a conversation about restricting guns. We absolutely do. When an 18-year-old can buy a military-level assault weapon, this is not a sustainable situation for a safe and secure society or safe and secure schools. There are solutions there if we can come together and talk about them. And I don't think there's not a one solution that's going to fit every situation. But if we can't even get together and talk about real solutions, then we're not getting anywhere. And that's the case with gun violence prevention, and that's the case with many other issues as well.
Do you see these possibilities as you're talking about being accomplished while still balancing the rights folks have with the Second Amendment?
Absolutely, yes. We are gun owners at my house. Here in Wisconsin, hunting is extremely a part of the culture and a part of a lot of people's lives, and there's no reason why that shouldn't continue. So there is a big difference between the Second Amendment rights when it relates to guns for hunting and self-protection, and there are absolutely, I believe, in Second Amendment rights and that people should be able to maintain them. I also believe that people have the right to live in a society where guns are absolutely not infringing on every aspect of our private lives.
In the final minute, Danielle Johnson, please share a couple of things that separate you from your opponent and what you would like voters to know about you that you already haven't discussed.
Thanks for that opportunity. Well, I would say as a veterinarian and a business owner, I'm a trained and proven problem solver. And I, unlike my, opponent, who's had the opportunity to take about 10 or 11 months off this year, if I were given the job, I'd really work a lot harder to solve the problems that face everyday Wisconsinites. The biggest difference between myself and my opponent that is the most glaring, I would say, is that related to abortion rights and women's bodily autonomy. So he is a no exceptions anti-abortionist, and I believe that there is no one more qualified to make the decision than the pregnant person, and that as women, we, in order to be full citizens under the eyes of the law, our judgment and needs to be primary in making those decisions.
That was Rick Ryer speaking with Danielle Johnson, the Democratic candidate for the state's 29th Assembly District. Republican incumbent Clint Moses did not respond to our invitation to speak with us for this program. Thank you for listening to our special election coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. You'll find all our candidate interviews after they air at WPR.org/election22. Next week, we'll hear from candidates in additional races. Find all our election coverage from stories to candidate interviews at WPR.org.